It should kick about halfway through, so generally around between 3 and 4 is somewhere where it's...
Thank you. Thank you very much. Sir, ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate very much those nice things you said, even though I have a bit of a guilty conscience as to whether they're deserved. Of course, that one thing about not needing an introduction, anyone in our business always thinks after a time that that's true, and we wish that it was so. But I'll never forget the time I was out speaking and a somewhat elderly lady came up to me. She couldn't have been sweeter. She took my hand in both of hers and she told me that she watched me all the time. I'd been on the General Electric Theater at that time about 6 years. And she said, I watch you, everything you do on television. I wouldn't miss a thing. My family makes fun of me because I even turn the set on to see you say, and leave the driving to us. But since I've been here today, and tonight especially, you have warmed my heart and your welcome has been wonderful. I can't help but think that when I stand up here and view of your kindness and this warm welcome, I try to, inside myself, explain it. I feel a little bit like the fella that had been in a saloon too long, and he finally staggered out into the open air and made it across the sidewalk where he got one arm around a lamppost, and he was kind of hanging there looking down at the water-filled gutter, and the moon was reflected in the water, and someone went by and he grabbed him, and he said, what's that? And the fellow looked and he said, why, that's the moon down there. And he says, yeah, what are we doing way up here? You know, it's hard to believe that one could approach the subject of the Constitution and worry about being controversial. But I think in the spirit of these times, almost anything is controversial. As a man knocked on a door one day and a small boy answered, and the man said, is your father home? And the kid said, no. And he says, your mother home? And the boy said, no. And finally, kind of nonplussed, the fella said, well, son, I'm your uncle on your father's side. And the kid said, well, I guess you can come in, but I'll tell you right now, you're on the wrong side. Perhaps some of you, it is, however, and in view of the observance here tonight, and the subject of this observance, it is very important that I should find something in the right words to say, and I feel this very keenly. Perhaps there have been some of you who've heard me explain, and sometimes in the past, what it's like to be in that spot and to feel so self-conscious with regard to choice of words. We had a fellow in our industry, show business, who was saving his money because he had a particularly fine voice and he aspired to be an opera singer. And he finally saved enough to go to Milan, Italy, and study voice. And after a few years of study, he received that highest honor that could come to any opera singer. He was invited to sing at La Scala, the spiritual fountainhead of opera. They were doing Pagliacci, and he sang the beautiful aria Vesti la Giubba. And when he'd finished singing, the applause from the balconies and the galleries and the orchestra seats was so thunderous and sustained they couldn't continue the opera until he repeated the aria as an encore. And again, the same sustained thunderous applause. And again, he sang Vesti la Giubba. And this went on till finally he motioned for quiet and he tried to tell them how full his heart was, what this welcome meant to him. But he said, I have sung Vesti la Giubba now 9 times. My voice is gone. I cannot do it again. And a voice from the balcony says, you'll do it till you get it right. Well, I will only make one try at it. One of the signers of the Declaration of Independence said it is not our duty to leave wealth to our children, but it is our duty to leave liberty to them. We have counted the cost of this contest and we find nothing so dreadful as voluntary slavery. And the declaration they signed then was unequivocal in its assertion that every man had unalienable rights to life and liberty and freedom of choice. And these were conferred on him at birth by the Creator. And then they augmented this declaration by drawing up the United States Constitution and its Bill of Rights. And 70 years later, Lord Acton of England would say of their effort, they had solved with astonishing and unexampled success two problems which had heretofore baffled the capacity of the most enlightened nations. They had contrived a system of federal government which prodigiously increased the national power and yet respected local liberties and authorities. And they had founded it on the principle of equality without surrendering the securities for property and freedom. And now we're engaged in a contest to see if the nation and the way of life they created can endure. There's a great deal of confusion about this contest. We're hesitant to recognize it for what it really is, but in reality, we're in a war. A war not only of nations, but of fundamental philosophies. A war between communism and capitalism. Now, there are some people who today flinch at the use of the word communism. They would find another name for it, as if by calling it something else, it might become something else, but it won't. Pravda, and the word in Russian means truth, Pravda, speaking of communism, says it is all-embracing, all-blood-soaked reality, and its goal is to destroy capitalism. There can never be a someday mixture of the two. Well, here I think we should be in complete agreement with them. For we can't be a little bit socialist, nor can we be partly free. Freedom is indivisible. It isn't spelled with an S. Dr. Howard Kirschner writes of a time when he visited the Kremlin, and there he was interviewed, or did interview, a high-ranking member of the Soviet government. And at one point in the afternoon's discussion, smiling pleasantly, this Soviet official said to Dr. Kirschner, "We'll be over to finish the takeover sooner than you think. You know that a mixed economy is not permanent, and you have already so much socialism with your formerly free economy that you cannot take it back or change. You are coming all the way into full socialism. We don't have to fight you or urge you. We shall simply wait until you walk voluntarily into our camp." Well, now, by contrast, in his sunset years, the late Herbert Hoover set out to study and see if he could determine, find some explanation for the wealth of this nation, the great industrial success. He found other lands were equal to us in natural resources. Other lands had climate similar to ours, had area equal to ours, and had people who were possessed of energy and talent and ability. Well, where then the difference? He found only one explanation, one thing that we had to a greater extent than any other people: freedom. And here, in this land, we have unleashed the individual genius of man, every man. We've given him the freedom of choice and the right to try, yes, to fail and to try again. His own initiative, the only limit to the heights that he can fly. What other explanation can there be for 6% of the world's population occupying 7% of the world's land surface? And it's a population that's really a polyglot mixture from all over the world. But in this limited territory, this small fraction of the Earth's population has created and today owns 50% of the world's wealth. But let it be recorded here that at the same time, we have distributed that wealth more widely among our people than any society heretofore created by man. Poverty here, for the most part, is measured by a scarcity of luxuries, not a lack of food and shelter. And yet somewhere a perversion has taken place. Rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government, and freedom is made divisible by the will of the majority. The Supreme Court, by a 5-4 decision, hands down a ruling so unconstitutional, it's hard to believe that the governors and the legislatures of the 50 states didn't rise in outraged shock at this destruction of our basic federal tradition. I speak of reapportionment. The citizens, or the court's outright denial of state sovereignty. Here it was made plain, would be the switch from a republic to the mobocracy of majority rule, the idea that 50% of the people plus one can perhaps in the future do whatever they please to the rest of the people simply because they outnumber them. Now, majority rule is a mechanism. It's a means of administering our affairs, but only if the rights of the individual are guaranteed by a set of ground rules. One's right to life and liberty and freedom, to worship, to speak, to assemble, in short, our inalienable God-given rights, may not be submitted to a vote. The very purpose of the Bill of Rights was to forever put them beyond the reach of majority rule. This is the unique heritage that we pass on to our children. And perhaps the time has come, and I think of no better occasion than to check on that heritage and see if the young people today will know the freedom that we've known and the freedom intended by the founding fathers. The trouble is, perhaps, that for too many years now we've talked of freedom in a kind of a tone of 4th of July oratory. We deal too often in nebulous abstract terms and not enough in specifics. Maybe that's the reason why a survey recently, a survey in depth of 5,000 young people between the ages of junior in high school and junior in college, revealed some startling things. And it was a survey in depth. When you stop to think that a television show can go off the air on the basis of a Nielsen survey of only 1,800 people nationwide, 5,000 young people, and more than half of them, said the government should have the ownership of banks and steel and other elements of heavy industry. And almost two-thirds of them said the government should provide jobs and workers should not produce all they can. And they rejected the profit motive as necessary to our welfare. And 84% of them said patriotism played no part in their lives. Well, perhaps in too many instances they've been reading textbooks that devote a chapter to public welfare and not one line to Patrick Henry. So they ask, well, who is free? At home, they've got their parents, and when they get to school, they've got teachers, and if they manage to get the old man's car and get out for the evening, there's a fellow on a motorcycle that causes them a little trouble now and then. Perhaps you and I should tell them in specifics what we mean by freedom. I'll never forget hearing one day from a man, a German immigrant. This man is a book publisher, fairly successful in this country, and he explained to me why he devotes so much of his time and his business of publishing to extolling the cause of freedom. Now, this was not a refugee from Hitlerism. This was a man who had gone to school in the Weimar Republic, when we believed that Germany had a system of government similar to ours, with a president and a parliament, and that we believed they were free. But he said, I was very fortunate, Mr. Reagan. He said, I sat in a class one day with a teacher who was trying to explain the meaning of freedom. And this teacher used this example. He said, suppose you were standing on the shores of the United States. And he said, ahead of you is 3,000 miles of country. And he said, you can move any place you want inside that 3,000 miles. Go as far as you want, stop where you want, stay as long as you want, and you don't have to ask anyone's permission. And he said, what do you think that meant to the small boy sitting in that class when there in the Weimar Republic, if we wanted to move from one apartment to another, we had to go to the city hall, to the police, and get a police permit? Well, let's start telling them what freedom means. It means selecting the college of your choice, or it means deciding not to go to college. It means choosing your own career. No one comes in on graduation day, as sometimes happens in so many states today in the world, and announces that the graduating class will report on the following day to the such and such industrial concern because that's where they're going to work. It means living where you want, taking a trip without going down and getting a permit and telling why you're leaving town, where you're going, how long you're going to stay, and checking in with the police at the town when you arrive. In Hungary, young people who are getting married, it is in the law that they must live either with his parents or hers until eventually, after a several year wait, the government gets around to assigning them to their quarters. In Russia, they've announced a new housing goal for urban housing. They want to provide 64 square feet of surface, floor surface, for each human being, a mere 8 by 10, or 8 by 8. And by coincidence here in the United States, that's the minimum requirement in our prison cell, is 8 by 10, 80 square feet. Let's talk to them not of a constitution that's revered because of dusty tradition, outmoded but tolerated because it's an antique. Let's make them understand it's a living document. It is a contract guaranteeing the most limited and equitable government ever known in the long history of man's relation to man. The Soviet Constitution has some clauses similar to ours. There's one in particular: we're guaranteed the right of assembly, the right to meet like this and to exchange ideas, the right to freedom of speech. There's such a clause in the Soviet Constitution. So maybe some people say, well, then wherein lies the difference? Well, the difference is so subtle it almost escapes us. And yet it is so great it tells the entire story. The Soviet Constitution says the government grants you these rights. And our Constitution says you're born with these rights and no government on earth can take them away from you. This is the most valuable part of the inheritance that we pass on to the young people. This idea, never before tried in the world, that you and I do have certain unalienable rights, that government is beholden to us, that it has no other source of power, and can do only those things permitted it by the sovereign people. But now there is a new philosophy abroad in the land. Men in high place in our government talk of the need for planning. They question the ability of the people to control their own destiny. And they chafe under the constitutional restraints, and they're impatient with the slow pace provided in the process for alteration by amendment. And so they embark on this dangerous folly of changing the Constitution by judicial interpretation. Oh, it's fine, the prodigious increase in national power of which Lord Acton spoke, but it's not so fine the respect for local authority. They ignore the word unreasonable in the interpretation of the article protecting a citizen's rights against search and seizure, against unreasonable search and seizure. They forget that word unreasonable, and suddenly crime skyrockets, and our streets become jungles as the hands of local law enforcement officers are tied by judicial decisions. Could you actually believe, and this is a case history, that a policeman on an afternoon when a Western Union office was closed could see two men coming out of this supposedly closed office carrying a burden which they were putting in an automobile, and he started over to see what was going on. They saw him coming, they jumped into the car, and they fled. He saw the door ajar, he commandeered a passing automobile, he overtook them, he pulled them over to the side of the road. And in the back seat of the car was a safe marked Western Union. That constituted illegal search and seizure. Case dismissed. Well, we take out of context welfare. We pretend there's a clause giving the central authority unlimited power to legislate what it believes is for the welfare of the people. There is not and never has been a welfare provision in our Constitution. An illegal interpretation says that when you have a word of that kind and then qualified by some 19 provisions, that explains, and from then on the Constitution prescribes that everything else not mentioned there, the right is reserved to the people. And so we embark on a plan to eliminate slums. Well, certainly no responsible citizen would suggest that Americans should live in degradation. But suddenly we discover we've canceled out our traditional laws of eminent domain, our protection against the seizure of our property. The government now can force the sale of our homes and resell them to other private individuals who will make a profit. And the entire transaction will be subsidized with our tax money. In the program called Urban Renewal to date, we have averaged selling back to private interest urban renewal properties for 30% of what we, the taxpayers, paid for them. And now, by a strange quirk of making the end justify the means, some people who deny the policeman the right to legitimate search and seizure in our protection rule that it's all right under the Agricultural Act for federal agents to seize a man's farm and sell it at auction if he has overplanted his allotment. And the Supreme Court rules, yes, the government has the right to tell a private citizen what he can raise on his own land for his own use. Free speech is interpreted as meaning that some young Americans have the right to burn draft cards and interfere with the shipment of munitions and supplies and reinforcements intended for other young Americans who are dying in a war that isn't a war, and they're denied at the same time the right to try for victory. There's no more noble purpose, I'm sure, than salvaging young people who, for whatever reason, have failed to meet their responsibility to fit themselves for adult life. But under federal welfare, we're taking young ladies from poverty-stricken homes. We're teaching them to become self-reliant. But while they're learning, they're provided with maid service so they won't have to make their own beds. And the program of retraining prorates out to $7,000 a year for each young lady we're going to save. Young men are in the similar program, and they go to retraining camps. And while they're being salvaged, they're paid a higher rate of pay than we give to the man in uniform who's defending his country. In Chattanooga, Tennessee, a school budget of $10 million was just announced for 25,000 students. But the federal program that's concerned with dropouts has a budget almost half that, $5 million, just to prevent or restore to training some 3,300 dropouts of the 25,000. And the legitimate students in those schools are limited to 15 hours of outside work if they have part-time jobs to earn money. But the dropout is paid for 32 hours, and it's paid from tax funds. And meanwhile, a United States senator says happily that spiritually and economically young people are being conditioned to respond to a liberal program of orderly policing of our own society by government. Well, that's an erudite way of saying they'll do as they're told. Perverting the Constitution so as to make equitable taxing for legitimate purposes a license to use the tax system to redistribute earnings and control the economy, we have used the people's money in order to coerce the people and to build a government beyond the consent of the governed. We recognize, of course, that government has certain legitimate functions. We're proud of those who set our course for the stars, who guard our shores, patrol our streets, who teach our children. We recognize and appreciate that government is a necessary referee to see that we don't impose on our neighbors in our daily competition with each other. But now government has assumed such a size that taxation has become the family's biggest budget item, a burden greater even than food and shelter. Since the beginning of our century, we have increased our gross national product to where it is 33 times as much as it was at the turn of the century. But in that same period, we've increased the cost of government 234 times, and we still haven't paid our way. We're going to let the young people in on that. We haven't balanced the budget 29 of the last 35 years. The interest on our debt now is $22,000 a minute, every minute of every hour of the 24, day in and day out. Our government owns a third of the real estate, and a few years ago it was only a fourth. Federal employees outnumber state employees in 30 of the 50 states. And in California, that's not easy. Did you ever stop to think that it only takes 12 doctors for every 10,000 of us to keep us well and healthy? It only takes 40 oil station attendants and mechanics for every 10,000 of us to keep our cars running. It takes 130 federal employees to administer the affairs of state for every 10,000 of us. Sometimes I think government is like a baby. It's an alimentary canal with an appetite at one end and no sense of responsibility at the other. But 200 years ago, the Constitution lighted a torch for the downtrodden of all the world. It said that here, men had recognized man's age-old yearning to be recognized as an individual, that here men had placed such a premium on individuality that we had pledged our collective strength, the strength of all, for the protection of even the least among us. And this belief cannot be reconciled with the high-sounding phrase, the greatest good for the greatest number. Since World War II, 135 young Americans, airmen, unarmed, have been shot down, for the most part simply because they strayed off course in an airplane and found themselves too close to the borders of a nation with which we are supposed to be at peace and which was formerly our ally. And we wrote notes of protest. And some time back, Americans were held captive and tortured by savage rebels in the Congo, and some of them murdered, while we debated the political consequence of going to their rescue. Let me, if I may, tell you a contrasting story. And we'll go back to around 1840. In Hungary, there had been a revolution. Even then, the Hungarians were trying for their freedom, and they had rebelled against the Emperor Franz Joseph of Austria. And the revolution was a failure. And some of them had fled to America. And one young lieutenant, a man named Kostya, Kostya fled to this country, took out his first papers, his intent to become a citizen, and he became an importer. And on a business trip, he was in the Mediterranean, in a Mediterranean port. And in the harbor was a gigantic sailing vessel, a flagship of the Austrian fleet. And we were a young, immature country back in 1840, and spies tipped off the crew and the officers of this Austrian ship that this wanted man, Kostya, was in the port. They kidnapped him and took him aboard to take him back to Austria and hang him. His manservant down on the waterfront recognized from descriptions his master had given him a flag on a little sloop. It was a sloop of the United States Navy. And he went aboard, and there he told the story of what had happened to his master to the captain of that ship, Captain Ingram of the Navy. And Captain Ingram took him to our consulate. And the consul, I guess even then, striped pants did something to human beings. The consul didn't want to take very much action with regard to this unknown man. And then when he found out that the man had only taken out his first papers and was not really a citizen as yet of this country, he felt that we could wash our hands of it. But Captain Ingram said, "I believe I am the ranking officer in this port." And he said, "Therefore, I think that I shall do what duty requires." And he had himself rowed out to the warship. And he said to the Austrian admiral, "I demand to see our citizen." And they brought the citizen on deck, the not yet citizen, bound in chains. And Captain Ingram said, "I can hear him better without those chains." So they removed the chains, and then he went forward and he said, "I'm going to ask you one question. Listen carefully and consider your answer. Do you ask the protection of the American flag?" And Kostya, who had been beaten and mistreated, nodded dumbly, "Yes." He said, "You shall have it." Late in the afternoon, two more Austrian warships sailed into the harbor. There were now three and one little American sloop. And Captain Ingram sent a lieutenant over with a message that said, "Any effort to leave this port with our citizen will be resisted by appropriate force. I will give you until 4 o'clock for a satisfactory answer." And as the clock approached four, and they stood looking at each other through the glasses from ship to ship, at a few minutes to four, Captain Ingram ordered the cannons rolled out into the ports. And then, as it was almost to the hour of four, he ordered the men standing by to light those tapers with which they lighted the fuses of the cannons. And at about that time, a man high on the lookout called down, "They're lowering a boat." And they rowed Kostya over to our ship and delivered him. And Captain Ingram went below and wrote his resignation to the United States Navy. He explained that he had done what he did because he believed he was sworn by his duty to protect any American, any place in the world, when his freedom and his rights were infringed upon. But if he had embarrassed our nation, he would now resign. His resignation was rejected on the floor of the United States Senate, where it was said at that time, "This battle we never fought may well turn out to be the most important battle in our nation's history." From that time on, and including today, there is a USS Ingram in the United States Navy. Pray God there always shall be. Now, I tell this not to be chauvinistic or to express a bullying hostility, a chip on the shoulder attitude, but because this is the highest function of government. Indeed, this is government's only excuse for even existing. Loyalty is a two-way street, and government's function is to see that no individual, no group in our midst, no outside aggressor can impose on the individual. What then must be our purpose? Well, to those who say there are no simple answers in today's complex world, yes, there is a simple answer. It's not an easy answer, but it's simple. If you and I will tell those who represent us that we want no double standard, we want no slightly immoral policy of political expediency on our behalf at the government level while we still practice a stricter, more moral attitude in our personal lives. Tell our representatives that we want legislation to reinterpret the Constitution in those instances where judicial rulings have distorted its meaning, to make it plain that this is a nation under God, and in God is our trust. And to those who today who cancel out this contract or relegate it to some musty display case of antiques, let us ask them, as Daniel Webster asked, but who shall reconstruct the fabric of demolished government? Who shall rear again the well-proportioned columns of constitutional liberty? Who shall frame together the skillful architecture which unites national sovereignty with states' rights, individual security, and public prosperity? And then he said to his fellow citizens, hold on, my friends, to the Constitution of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands. Miracles do not cluster. What has happened once in 6,000 years may never happen again. Hold on to your Constitution, for if the American Constitution shall fall, there will be anarchy throughout the world. If you and I fail, if you and I fail in this charge, our failure may well be recorded someday in a book yet to be written called The Rise and Fall of the United States of America. If you and I fail and are unwilling to meet the challenge of these times, then we'd better start rehearsing what it is we'll tell our children we found more precious than freedom. I'm sure they'll want to know. Thank you.